welcome to First Things First. I'm Jenna Wolf. That is the Hall of Famer Chris Carter. This is Nick Wright. We've got a great show for you today. Boy, if you were anywhere near the Garden last night, you might have heard the roars from the opposing fans because James Harden went off again. Wait till you hear how big his night was. At least one Pittsburgh Steeler knows how to solve the Antonio Brown dilemma. We'll hear from him. But we're going to start the show with half of the Super Bowl participants, the New England Patriots. The Patriots, who fully and wholeheartedly have embraced the role of underdogs. They did it in the AFC title game, and it worked. Julian Edelman's hashtag bet against us went viral. In fact, during that game, Edelman was seen on the sideline telling Tom Brady, "Hey, you're too old," as they both laughed. And while the underdog mentality worked once, it's hard to believe they can still ride that into their third straight Super Bowl. But CC, I'll start with you. Can they? If it worked then, can it work again, even though they aren't technically underdogs?
That means I would have to assume that it worked. Like, see, I don't believe in the underdog mentality. I believe in people using it, but actually being able to give you information to say, does this work? Sometimes it works. Most of the time, it doesn't work. Because regardless of who you are, favorite underdog, your assignments don't change in the game. Bill Belichick is not going into the locker room with the Patriots saying, "Hey, you know something, guys? No one believes in us." He doesn't coach that way. They don't coach that way. They coach based on what they're trying to do, what their strengths are. We're going to take away those strengths. And what he tells them is, "I need you to do this. This is your job, and this is how you're going to be successful." So to think that Bill Belichick, who runs this whole thing, is sitting around telling Tom Brady, "Hey, you're too old," to try to motivate him. No, he doesn't coach that way. Now we got the soundbite of Edelman and everything, and we think that, oh, every player is saying things like that. No, they're not. Edelman is an underdog. He always has been an underdog. Wasn't highly recruited out of high school. Went to Kent State as a quarterback. He wasn't going to be able to play quarterback in the NFL. So he's always been an underdog. So he could gravitate to that type of identity. Tom Brady, let's not forget, in 2000, there was a reason why those six rounds went past and all those players were drafted. Then the New England Patriots decided to draft Tom Brady. So ever since that day, and or when he was benched at Michigan, Tom Brady was always going to be an underdog. So he doesn't need Edelman. He doesn't need anything else. That's one of the things that's led to his overall greatness. He shows up to work like an underdog, like when he showed up in the NFL. So this has always been Tom Brady's mantra. He's always marched to this beat, even when Drew Bledsoe. When he took over for Drew Bledsoe, when they had the game-winning drive in the first Super Bowl, the coach had told him, "Hey, Tom, don't blow it." Drew Bledsoe whispered in his ear before he went out for the game-winning drive.
Go win the game.
Go win the dang-on game. So Tom Brady, man, has been under this, "No one believes in me. No one is giving me a chance. I've been the underdog." So for Tom Brady, yes, Bill Belichick doesn't coach that way. And the Patriots, as a team, they don't think and operate that way.
And even if you can convince yourself, mind meld yourself to believe the greatest dynasty in NFL history, a team that had prior to this year been to 3 of 4 Super Bowls, a team that had come within a drive of winning last year's and had won the year before, was an underdog last week, that script has now flipped. That all the Vegas money, if we're talking favorites, underdogs, is on the Patriots. That's how the line moves from Rams -1 to yesterday it touched Patriots -3. It's now Patriots -2.5. All of the narrative this week has been, there have been two discussions. One has been about a blown call where people are basically saying the wrong team won. That makes the Rams being disrespected if they want to take that mantle. And the other has been about the amazing sustained greatness of the New England Patriots. This week, we're at Thursday, has been about what a marvelous performance from Tom Brady, even though he wasn't that good the first 3.5 quarters of that football game. Julian Edelman talking about, we're too slow, you're too old. Even though Edelman, up until the final moments of that game, had a couple grievous errors. One,
oh, absolutely,
on a punt that he got bailed out on by a replay. And then two plays later, ball goes off his hands, Brady to Edelman. That got the Chiefs right in position to take the lead in that football game. So I don't. You had to kind of trick yourself, if you're a Patriot, into believing no one believes in us. But they were actual underdogs last week. They were on the road. It was just the second time in a decade of playoff football they've been actual underdogs. Now they're back in their familiar place, the favorite and the story and the team that everyone is trying to chase.
And last week's game, Kansas City, we know about Patty Mahomes, 50 touchdowns. We know about Kansas City and Arrowhead. But let's talk about New England, 3-5 on the road. Three times lost by double digits. That's the reason why that rarity that you were, we were not the favorite.
Absolutely.
Because I'm going to kill this underdog.
Right, not the favorite.
That's the reason why you weren't the favorite, because how you performed on the road during the 2018 season.
So tell me why then they are favorites in this game, because Brady didn't play that well last week. They did have a worse record than the Rams in the regular season. On paper, some would say they're the less talented team, maybe not at the quarterback position than the other team, maybe not at the coaching position, but all the other players. So why then, after all that, are they the favorite?
Because they have played their two best games of the year in their last two games. They absolutely annihilated the Chargers, a team that had a better record than them. They destroyed the Chiefs in the first half, a team that had a better record than them. And we have been reminded that, as Chris said off the air, I'm going to bring it on the air for a moment, I'm done picking against the Patriots till they're done winning. Like, and I think a lot of people are taking that mentality, which is, even if it's like, man, they're on the road, they've stunk on the road, Brady is, even if you think I have downgraded how good Brady's been this year, no one thought he was better than Mahomes this year. No one thought the Patriots had a wide receiver that was better than Tyreek Hill, a tight end better than Travis Kelce, and it didn't matter. And so the other thing that I think is happening right now is, as much as people like Sean McVay, and I think he is a brilliant coach, people recognize everyone's fighting for second place on the game planning schematic edge because of what Belichick, what they did to the Chargers, then what they did to the Chiefs, particularly in that first half.
Well, if you look at just the roster, I think New England has 36 players that played in the Super Bowl. The Rams have 4 players. So if we calculate that to minutes that the Rams have actually prepared for a Super Bowl, and I would give them the 2 weeks. If we calculate all the minutes compared to all the thousands of minutes that the Patriots and their front office, it's only Thursday, the week before the Super Bowl. I can guarantee you today, New England is way ahead of the Rams in hotel rooms, tickets, who's coming to Atlanta, getting their lives organized, knowing when they're going to leave at the end of this weekend, what they're going to do in Atlanta. They should be a prohibitive favorite given the overall experience. Forget the football, of the other things that go on in preparing for football, because they have so much of information that they can go back on. Times that they made mistakes in housing, the times that they didn't have the wives close to the players. They lost the Super Bowl based on some stuff like that. Players not happy before the game. So they should be a drastic favorite, given their overall experience and how they're going to handle the biggest week typically in your athletic career, a week that they've had before.
So Tom Brady has played in more Super Bowls than the entire Rams roster combined. Chris mentioned 4 guys on the Rams have played in a Super Bowl. I can't think of all 4 off the top of my head, but I can think of 2. Aqib Talib, who do you play in a Super Bowl with?
Denver.
Well, Denver, correct. And then Brandon Cooks, who do you play? Denver, they had to beat the Patriots to get there. My apologies. And then also Brandon Cooks, who do you play in a Super Bowl with? The New England Patriots. C.J. Anderson also went to one with Denver as well. And then there's a 4th player. But so, like, you've got the lead up to it and the ability to know how to use the 2 weeks to your advantage. And I said this going into the Chiefs game. This was, from a fan perspective, the biggest game for Chiefs fans in 50 years. This was about the 9th or 10th biggest game the Pats have played in this decade. That trickles down to the players to a degree as well.
And that's going to be the same thing heading into the Super Bowl, probably up and down across the roster. Take a break coming up. Talk some basketball. James Harden with a performance for the ages. That's next on First Things First. Welcome back. We'll get to James Harden's big night in a second, but first, a couple plays from last night. College basketball, this is Tennessee's Jordan Bowden with the one-handed dunk right off the inbound pass.
Great inbounds play. Great scripted play. on the other side of the bucket. He comes from the other side,
from
the three-point
wing.
Line.
Yep.
They fall asleep.
This is a play that nearly every AAU team in America has a variation of, and they run successfully about 8% of the time.
Hawks,
the alley-oop off the inbounds. Oh, my.
Justin Anderson drives baseline, puts Bobby Portis on a poster.
Oh, get up, Justin Anderson. Big, oh, a little pump fake. Couple dribble, left-handed yam all over Bobby Portis. Bobby, you're there for your rim protection. Come on now, man. I appreciate the contest. Got to do a little better than that, though. Justin Anderson, not exactly known as a high flyer. Got to do better, Bobby.
Finally, Jazz Nuggets. Donovan Mitchell spins, hits Will Barton with a Euro step before laying it in. Boom, boom.
Might not look like it. They just, like his feet, they large Euro steps. Donovan Mitchell got off to a slow start in his sophomore season, starting to catch fire. His team's playing a lot better, too, the last month.
He also had a monster block in this game. I think Utah's won 8 of 10, got themselves firmly back in the playoffs in the Western Conference.
He's got some big feet, man. I saw him play. I couldn't even ask him for his shoes. I knew they weren't going to fit.
Moving on to the big story here in New York City last night, James Harden. We're running out of ways to describe the historic run that he's been on. It continued last night as the Rockets visited the Knicks. Harden poured in a career-high 61 points. He had 15 boards in Houston's win at the Garden. It was Harden's fifth game with at least 50 this season, and the first time a player has had 60 points and 15 boards since Shaq back in 2000. And by the way, the 61 points, that tied Kobe for the most ever scored by a visitor at Madison Square Garden. Here is James Harden.
This is one of the historical buildings in a sport that we have. Obviously, the fans are one of the best that we have in this league. And so it was pretty cool to come out here and just put on a show for them.
At this point in the season, what do you need to work on as a team to move up?
We have to get healthy. That's the most important thing. We get healthy and we'll move forward from there. But obviously, Clint is out a little bit longer, but Chris will be back very soon. And as long as we can get healthy and catch a rhythm, everything else will be great.
All right, but even if they don't get healthy, they seem to be doing just fine with number 13 out there. Nick, how impressive has not only Harden's night last night, but this recent run that he's been on?
I think the most impressive thing about it is it's no longer surprising. See, I know you watched the game, but if you hadn't watched the game and you got here this morning and you said to me, what happened in the Knicks game last night? And I said, pick one. Harden scored 21 or Harden scored 61. What's more likely?
Oh, definitely the 60.
The 60, like, it is not unexpected.
I know.
He's, in his last five games, he has scored 261 points. That's 52 a game. He has made 76 field goals in that span. Zero have been assisted. Now, we talked about this on his last big night when zero were assisted. And people, I think, misconstrued that to mean he's not getting other people involved. No, he has 21 assists in this stretch. It means he is scoring in the hardest way possible. No back cuts that he gets the ball and gets an easy layup. For context, see, Clay's 44-point night the other night, a couple days ago, all of his baskets were assisted. So James is doing this it, as an offense unto himself. In this five-game stretch, the Rockets have made 192 baskets. He has scored or assisted on 97 of them. His teammates have done 95. Just real quick, if we can just show the audience in these five games, it's been 20-plus games, but these five games, what he's done compared to what his teammates have done. He has scored 261 points. His teammates are at 338. He's done it in less than 200 minutes. They've had more than 1,000.
Wow.
This is the closest thing I've come in my lifetime see to what it must have been like to watch Wilt, where it was an offense unto himself for weeks on end, where he has to do everything on one end of the court for his team to have a chance.
Yeah, and we haven't seen this type of workload put on a star player in a long, long time. I would say LeBron, early in his career, he had that. But this is more based on injury. He's doing this out of necessity for the team to be able to win. So part of it you can look at and been like, man, he's in a window where he's playing some of the best basketball the NBA's ever seen. And it's also out of need, out of desperation for them in the West, for them to be able to stay in contention, to have one of those top four seeds. It's necessary. He's got two other starters that are out and been out for an extended period of time. This is their style that they're going to run. And to me, the thing that's more impressive about him being able to score is just his overall endurance and how Harden has never been an elite athlete as far as body, jumping, playing above the rim, but his overall endurance and being able to dribble the basketball, stay focused, and to be able to continue to score night after night after night, that to me is very impressive. The Garden is an impressive place to play. We haven't seen too many big nights in the Garden because the Knicks haven't been good, so I know the Garden's a legendary place. The Knicks right now are not playing in a position where they're adding to that legacy. So I don't necessarily want to be like, oh, man, it's one of the greatest games ever in the Garden. Everyone's coming to the Garden doing something. Harden hadn't had a Garden moment. 36 points was his high before. He really wanted to have one. Said that yesterday, delivered last night.
And they needed it, by the way. If people didn't watch, it was only a four-point win. It was a steal and a Harden dunk that actually cemented the win after it looked like the Rockets were going to blow it late. There was a bizarre inbounds play between Eric Gordon and P.J. Tucker. And so they needed every last drop out of Harden last night.
How much of the game plan, how much of what we're seeing, how much of the production changes when Chris Paul and Clint Capella or Chris Paul or Clint Capella come back?
Well, this streak started with Clint Capella out there. Like, Clint Capella hasn't been out for the 22 games where he's averaging 43 points a night to go along with 8 assists. Clint Capella was there for the majority of that. Now, it will change, hopefully, for the Rockets considerably when Chris Paul's out there. Then, all of a sudden, maybe some of Harden's baskets will be assisted. But I think it's important to note two things. One is, I know this is a year of offensive explosion. We've talked about this, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have to look at numbers within that context. But no one else in the league is averaging 30 a night. He's averaging 36 a night. He's 7 points higher than the number two scorer in basketball. And during this offensive explosion by him, which is now at 22 games, no team in the league has more wins. We thought when Chris Paul went down, or at least I did, that they'd look a lot like what they looked like last year when Chris Paul went down, which is struggling to win any games. When they get him back, which will be sooner than Capella, then you start looking at them, oh, are they the only team that is, forget a threat to the Warriors, are they the second best team in the Western Conference, which is where the hierarchy could fall this season?
Yeah, I only think Golden State is only a threat to themselves. I don't believe Houston will be a threat. How they're going to play basketball has to change drastically. Last night they had two guys that had more than 8 shots. You cannot beat the Warriors or the top teams in the NBA. Say the Warriors weren't there, I don't think Houston would be a championship team. Because you need more variance in being able to score the basketball. They're going to have more people in the playoffs. When you get in the 7-game series, they're going to make sure that he's not able to dribble the basketball. So they're going to trap him. So they're going to have to play basketball different when Chris Paul comes back, when Capella comes back, when they get into the playoffs.
We had Daryl Morey, the general manager of the Houston Rockets, on the show yesterday. And we asked him about the training, the preparedness and the preparation and the athleticism that goes into having nights like this and how sustainable that is. Is there fear at all that he doing all this now, he may not be available this way in the playoffs?
Listen, the Rockets, as Daryl talked about, track all of this, and they try to make sure via the way they practice or a lack thereof that he is well equipped to handle it at the end of the year. But sometimes we talk about these things as if they have a better option. They have to win games. They can't blow games to the Knicks. They needed every last one of those 60 last night in order. It doesn't matter how fresh Harden is if the Rockets are the 8 seed,
right,
and they get the Warriors in the first round. And so they are doing what is necessary due to the injuries. But James Harden is making me question what is possible for a wing scorer in today's NBA. I didn't think it was possible for a guy to average 43 a night for 2 months. And that's what, for a month and a half, going on 2 months. Like, that is what he's doing. Last night he had 23 point attempts to go along with 20 free throw attempts. He keeps putting up box scores that if you type them into Basketball Reference, they're one of one in all of NBA history. And so, yeah, the fatigue is an issue. I know that's been one of your big concerns.
I mean, fatigue is going to be an issue. It has been an issue before when he didn't have the type of workload that they have now. Now, Daryl, I really appreciate his opinion. But everybody's monitoring their workload, but no one's playing like him. No one's going to get 61 points with no assist on there. So I understand when you work out, there's a certain amount of information that goes in the computer. They spit out this data. But there's also a human aspect, and there's an amount of energy that you burn in being, I don't have any help. I must do this. Harden had 36 at halftime. So some of the stuff you can monitor, the other stuff you can't monitor. To me, this is about James Harden getting his second MVP. I don't believe they have one chance at winning an NBA championship against the Warriors. To me, it's about his own individual ability, how he's grown his game, and out of desperation, through injury, he put together this remarkable season.
And C, to your point, if he does get his second MVP, you're going to be able to, on an individual level, not the championship level, stack these 5 years that he's put together up against some of the all-timers. It'd be two MVPs, two second places, both of which some people made an argument he should have won that year, and only one, quote, down year in the mix. It has been now a half decade of offensive dominance by James Harden.
And James Harden even said this week he wants to be in the same conversation one day with Wilt and Michael and Kobe, and he's definitely working himself into that conversation. Coming up, could Antonio Brown actually return to the Steelers? That's next on First Things First. Back here, First Things First. We're now joined by three-time Super Bowl champ Mark Schlereth. Hey, Mark.
How are you?
Thanks for coming back.
It's a pleasure
being with
to be
us.
Back.
All around TV diva.
All around.
You guys should have seen him. I wish we had it on video before the segment. Sprawled out.
Yeah.
At least four different people working on
it.
But you needed it, so
yeah,
and
I
now
did.
Look
yeah.
at
yeah.
you.
Look
so
at me now. I'm just
you're perfect.
Chipper.
Stink. It was another drama-filled season for the Steelers, and with the latest Antonio Brown saga, it appears to be another drama-filled off-season with the Steelers as well. It is unlikely Antonio Brown will be back in a Steelers uniform next year. Pittsburgh's owner himself casting doubt on return. But Steelers center Marquise Pouncey believes things will get worked out, saying the good phone conversation or a good sit-down could solve all the discord and that time heals everything. Seems a little far-fetched to think that that's all it would take,
right.
but what do you think, Stink? Can this be resolved at this point where both sides are?
I think from most players' perspective, it's the locker room can be very forgiving. So from a locker room standpoint, you're like, yeah, we'll get our guy back. You know, we'll
even
patch it over.
Even the way he did last year?
Absolutely. For guys, I think they'll overlook those things. And they'll say, hey, it's all good. I just don't think they can bring him
the
back.
The locker room's not normal, man.
Right, the locker room's
not normal. You're sitting over here like, right. Well, how could you let someone work like that?
He didn't even show up.
We don't care.
Yeah, it would be like, hey, man, you know what? You screwed up. Come on in here. Yeah, like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's the village idiot, but he's our village idiot. So we want to keep him in, you know, I mean, that's how the locker room.
And a very useful village idiot.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I'm just saying that we will embrace that. We want to help guys. We want to fix guys.
There's less talented players with more significant issues that are in that locker room that we accept. So this is not your normal work environment. So if you think of it as, oh man, you've never been in a situation like no locker room.
Mm-mm.
When you talk to NFL players, guys who have played, guys who played to a high level, guys like Stink, you ask them, man, what do you miss? Absent of the money, they miss the locker room. Because you'll never have that collection of people, personalities, ethnic differences, different backgrounds in the same work environment ever again. It's a time in your life that you will never be able to recapture. And people say, oh, the locker room chemistry. Man, it's a hodgepodge of a bunch of stuff with one goal. Man, we're trying to play some football and try to play at a high level. Don't even be talking about everyone here trying to win a championship, because that is not the goal of every single player. So that's the way an NFL locker room and the makeup of an NFL locker room is.
But correct me if I'm wrong, that you're talking about the players. It's not surprising that Marquise Pouncey would welcome him back.
Sure.
But those aren't the guys who would be executing a trade. The people who he might have a bigger issue with are the actual decision makers.
Well, here's the issue. The players would welcome him back. The players would find a way to get over it. Come on, Ben Roethlisberger was like, oh, they're the ones that have the beef,
and
right?
They,
and he's
sure
like, oh, no, we're fine. I reached out to him on Thursday. I don't know what's going on. Like, the players would just let it go because he's so talented, and they'll figure out a way to welcome him back in and everything will be hunky-dory. It's you can't have him with that coach.
Right.
Because he has circumvented that coach's authority time and time and time again, and that coach hasn't held him to a standard of accountability that he needs to hold him to. And so the two of them, if you bring him back, will he continue to walk over the coach? Well, of course he will, because he's been entitled to do that. He has been given the authority to circumvent that coach's authority.
Right.
So he's been, hey, you don't have to play by any rules. You have your own set of standards. And so I know one thing about the Steelers. What have they had, three coaches?
In 50 years.
Yeah, three coaches in 50 years. So they have a desire to make that work. And Tomlin will never be given kind of full reign of that organization as long, in my opinion, as Antonio's there. So I think you have to move him as an organization.
The Steelers have had more continuity at the coaching spot than any organization in the league. And they have had more turnover of elite-level wide receivers than any organization in the league, which is why, even though Antonio is a special player, and I almost always defer to the special player, I said it. The day after this story came out, on the Monday or Tuesday after week 17, he can't come back in that locker room as long as Mike Tomlin's the head coach. Now, they could have fired Tomlin. I would have thought that would have been a mistake. They could have maybe tried to trade Tomlin. That would have been interesting, but they're not doing that either. So you have to shop Antonio Brown, and there's a drop-dead date on this. He's due a roster bonus the fifth day of the league year early in March. The draft is the next month in April. This will be resolved, and Antonio Brown, at 3 years, $36 million left on his contract, is a hell of a bargain. And maybe, I'm sure, a new team will think he won't act like this here, or we'll have a better handle on it, or we'll be able to control it better, or we don't care, we'll just get the production out of him. But I'm not surprised that Pouncey, especially knowing what I know about Pouncey and the Pouncey brothers, think, eh, this ain't no big deal. But for Mike Tomlin, to use your quote, see, it's going to be, you bring him back, there's spitballs being shot at the coach by week five. Like, there is, he has done sports-wise what is as bad of a thing as you can do to your teammates. No show, no call. And the teammates might get over that. I don't know how the coach can look the other guys in the eye and bring him back in.
That's my only issue with it, and that's what I didn't understand. So just explain it to me better. It's not like he had some off-the-field situation where the teammates are like, well, it didn't affect the game. It's not great, but we'll bring him back. This could have affected the game. You always say your best skill is your availability or how you phrase it, but he wasn't available to them in the most important game of their season. And I'm fascinated by the fact that you think the players or that team is just so open to bringing him back. Maybe not the brass and the coaching staff, but yet the teammates.
Yeah, I don't think you're fascinated. I think you're surprised and shocked. But it's the personality of athletes. Look in America. America, we're waiting for someone to apologize. That's all you got to do. No matter what you've done, if you apologize, we're very, very forgiving. From an athletic standpoint, we're even more forgiving because we understand some of the things they take. I think the Pittsburgh Steelers, the players, they understand the rub tug between him and Ben Roethlisberger better than we do sitting here on television. So I've been in the locker room long enough. These types of things are resolved. You got 60 guys coming from all different types of personalities. So his talent and how he works at work. See, because one thing you guys are missing is all he no-showed, all he didn't call. He's the hardest worker in the building. There was a reason for that. He had a serious issue with Ben Roethlisberger. He's like, I'm tired of you showing me up. You're not going to show me up anymore. So it's not as if this guy is not known for being a hard worker. That's why the no-call, no-show thing is not termination of his career.
Not because of his career, but do you – maybe I'm wrong. Maybe because we've talked about this a lot. Do you think – do you disagree with Stink? Do you think the Steelers can, with Mike Tomlin there, bring him back? Forget the players for a moment, because the players don't execute trades. Maybe I've misunderstood your opinion on this when we've talked about it the last month. I thought we agreed that what Stink was saying is accurate, that Mike Tomlin can't look the other guys in the eye in the locker room having brought
right.
him back.
I'm separating the issues, though. I'm trying to tell you players will still accept it. Now, what they decide to do in the locker room. Now, you keep saying players don't execute trades. All that's true. But front office people aren't in the locker room. The coaches aren't in the locker room. Every coach, every team, everything I've ever heard, the coach always said that locker room belongs to who?
The players.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And don't forget that. So what they decide to do upstairs, if they get past that date, they give him that bonus. If they get to the draft, they have decided that they're going to allow him to be in the locker room. And I got some legendary Pittsburgh Steelers. I'm talking about the best of the best. And they had highly questionable teammates, all along the way. So now, it wasn't typically the best players. It wasn't Mean Joe Green,
right.
Mel Blount. Well, this time we have with Antonio. But their understanding of players in a culture room, of a locker room, that's what I'm trying to get Jenna and others to understand.
Right. I think you have to also understand how compartmentalized the locker room is. So I can be Antonio Brown's teammate, and I can be disgusted with the way he behaves, but I don't have to interact with him.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm in my meeting room. I'm in my section of the locker room. I'm on my portion of the practice field. And as long as he's doing his job and he's working hard and he's out there making plays for us, that's all right. I'll tolerate that. Like, it doesn't mean you have to sit there and say, we accept you, it's fine. You know, they're oftentimes...
Most players don't put themselves in the front office position saying who should be on the team and who shouldn't be on the team. That's what we do on television. But most guys in the locker room, they're not sitting there trying to alter a guy's career because that could have been them. Because they know people a lot in that
situation. And most players want as much talent as possible in the locker room. They want
it makes my job easier.
Of course. Yeah,
but you've also seen a player like Antonio who do some of the things that he has done. And eventually it gets down to the point where there'll be a fight in the locker room. Somebody will go up and challenge him, and then there's going to be fisticuffs, and that happens. I mean, that happens as well. So the locker room is just it's a really different place. And you can't compare it to any other place in America because it doesn't run by the same rules.
All right, Mark, stick around. Coming up, did Jerry Jones make a big mistake? That's next on First Things First. Big Ten College Hoops action is coming your way tomorrow on FS1. Michigan battling Indiana in a conference showdown. All tips off at 6 Eastern on FS1 and the Fox Sports app. Back here with Mark Schlereth, we are going viral. So Tom Brady and the Patriots are preparing to take on a tough Rams defense in Super Bowl 53. But there's another opponent New England should actually be more concerned with, and that's Jets safety Jamal Adams, who absolutely demolished the Patriots mascot at Pro Bowl practice. Demolished.
That I understand the mascot's got some cushioning. I get that.
Guy still hurt.
That landing couldn't have been pleasant for him. And then the reaction of the other Pro Bowl players who he runs over to on the sideline, who were so excited to see him do this to pat the Patriot. I mean, it looks like the mascot enjoys it because that's the only facial expression
he can
have.
I was just going to say, he was smiling.
It looks fine, but then, the mascot, you can't tell otherwise. That looked like it was painful for that fellow.
Well, I think he's going to be fine, and that's the first time a Jet has hit a Patriot in years. So, right?
I mean, good for them.
Everybody's laughing because everybody's so jealous how good the Patriots are. They're like, look, you know what? They just can't get it done on the field.
All you can do is beat the mascot.
Yeah.
That Patriot got to hold the L.
Time now for stories to start your morning. Start with some bad news for the Pacers. Victor Oladipo suffered a serious injury to his right knee last night. He'll have an MRI today, but the Pacers fear they've lost Oladipo for the year. Nick, how devastating is this?
Well, listen, this is a team that, against a lot of odds, has stayed in the top four of the East all year long, and that now is over in a matter of weeks. He is, even though his statistical production hasn't been what it was last year, he has been the heart and soul of that team and the best player on that team. The only silver lining for him is he already signed a long-term extension, so he will have plenty of time to get healthy on company time, if you will. But this stinks.
And I would watch the reports coming out. I believe there could be a couple different injuries here. You saw the training staff when they came out, immediately they begin to cover his leg up. Mm-hmm. That's not a torn ACL or MCL. There's something else going on there. So we wish him well, speedy recovery. Good story, too, with them losing Paul George, him being the face of that franchise.
All right, to the NFL now. Larry Fitzgerald has agreed to a one-year deal to return to the Cardinals for a 16th season. Fitz ranks second in the NFL history in receiving yards, third in receptions, and tied for sixth in receiving touchdowns. See, you excited to see him back out there again next year?
I can't say I'm as excited as other NFL fans are. I know the NFL is, because he's one of the true, true great men that we have. Arizona and their ownership, they got a young team there not winning a lot. But for myself, though, I get concerned. All right, if he wants to play football, him and I have had this conversation. He's still enjoying it, so I'm happy for him that he's enjoying it.
And concerned because just long-term health and things like that. You mentioned that he's second in yards. The guy, it's not like he can get to first. Jerry's ahead of him by 6,000. So he's doing it, and he's made more money than any receiver ever by a wide margin. He's doing it because he wants to keep playing, and I'm sure Josh Rosen's happy that they've got Larry Fitzgerald another year.
That name right there is the reason why I'm not happy.
Consummate professional. I will say this. The league's a better place when Larry Fitzgerald's in it.
One of the best people in football.
Yeah.
Finally, while the Super Bowl is pretty evenly matched, that according to Vegas and all, the quarterback matchup seems slightly one-sided. I did say slightly. Jared Goff heading to his first ever Super Bowl. Tom Brady practically invented the Super Bowl. Goff, who floundered in year one under Jeff Fisher, has prospered in years two and three under Sean McVay. And after the win on Sunday, offensive tackle Andrew Whitworth heaped praise on the young quarterback.
You know what? He's just a special kid. I've said it since, you know, we really came to training camp, and really since the day I met him, I've realized that he's a special kid. And you know what? I told my wife before this playoff started, this is the first year that it really wasn't about me. I really honestly felt like I was more nervous for this playoffs because I believe in Jared Goff and I believe that he deserves to win. And I just want to be right about that. And that's what it means the most to me. And I can't be more proud of him.
All right, Stink, when you look at what Jared Goff has lying ahead of him for this big game, how much, you know, is he going to have to contend with this Patriots defense?
Well, I mean, they'll certainly have a plan like they had with Patrick Mahomes. They're going to take away some of your weapons. There's no question about that. I was so impressed with Jared Goff and his ability to manage that game early in that crowd noise. There's nothing like playing in New Orleans when the New Orleans Saints are good. Then you couple that with the playoffs. It is a miserable place to try to play offensive football. And you saw that early in the game. And to weather that storm, to go through that. And I was talking to Whitworth and just about Jared Goff in general. And there was a Thursday night game where Whitworth had given up a sack. But it was Jared Goff who essentially drifted in the pocket, didn't climb the pocket, gave up the sack. And, you know, it went on Whitworth. And so Whitworth goes, the next morning he called me like six times to apologize. He felt so bad. He's text messaging. And finally, Whitworth is like, hey, kid, it's fine. Quit calling me. Like, I'm going to be, like, I'm all right. I'm a big boy. But, like, he has got that team. He is the unquestioned leader of that team. He has got their, he's earned their respect by the way he handles his business. And I'm telling you what, his ability and what they did as an offense in New Orleans when they were struggling and they found a way to come back in overtime and put that drive together to get to get the field goal. It just is amazing. He's played exceptionally well.
You mentioned in overtime the most underrated and under-discussed part of this football weekend was the drive the Rams executed after the Saints took the lead at the tail end of regulation. Everyone focused on the missed call. Everyone focused on the other things that went around it. But you are inside the two-minute warning. You have one timeout. You're down three with the trip to the Super Bowl on the line. And Jared Goff made some throws now. And I have been more skeptical of him than most. I thought he was made some enormous plays late in the game to set up the 48-yard Greg Zuerlein field goal, which is the only reason we got to overtime in that game. The 57-yarder was almost set up by the Drew Brees pick and then just, I think, two positive plays. But what he was able to do, and I think most people watching that game thought, when you see Jared Goff running to the far side of the field talking to the receiver, when you see their inability to communicate, when you see the bad luck of one of his first passes of the game goes off Todd Gurley's hands, and now all of a sudden the Saints have the ball again, that this was about to be a snowball rolling downhill. His ability to overcome that, I think, should prepare him well for the Patriots defense. But as we've seen from the Pats and saw in the AFC Championship game, Belichick will have something ready for him that he has not seen yet this season and probably hasn't seen in his career.
There's two keys to Jared Goff going against this New England defense. Number one is the question, will he wake up before Patty Mahomes did? Patty Mahomes didn't wake up till halftime. Patty Mahomes didn't realize what they were trying to do with Tyreek Hill, the single coverage on Kelce early in the game, and couldn't take advantage of it. And Will Jared Goff take the challenge of running the football with his legs? If you want to hurt the New England defense with their principles and everything, that's what I know they are not preparing for. And there's going to be three or four plays earlier in the game. It's not going to be clean. He can run and utilize his legs, and I think that would hurt and make New England make some huge adjustments, because that's not something stink that type of defense with him, the type of quarterback, that they won't account for. And he's a better athlete than people give him credit for.
If you look at this Patriots team, you'd say, well, they are where they are this year because of Tom Brady. So some might disagree. But if you look at the Rams team, would they be in this position without Jared Goff in the season he had?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, he's been incredible. And, you know, I mean, it's everybody. It's Todd Gurley, it's Jared Goff, and it's Sean McVay calling plays. And I will tell you this. If they try to take out, like, Cooks, for instance, they're still going to get Cooks the ball. Unlike Andy Reid and the Kansas City Chiefs decided not to get Tyreek Hill the ball, not to hand it to him on a jet sweep, not to fake a jet sweep and throw a screen, not to – like, that's inexcusable. But that won't happen under Sean McVay's watch. If you're trying to take out and double team, you're trying to double team Cooks, man, they're going to line up in a stack and a bunch, and they're going to run a shallow cross with him.
They will find a way to let
him make some plays. But Jared Goff has been exceptional, and they've done an exceptional job from a design standpoint of making sure that he throws so many five-step drops without a hitch and throws it to the one intended target, because they do a great job with design and a great job of him understanding that design.
All right, let's turn to the Cowboys now. Yes, they did win the NFC East, and yes, they did win a playoff game for the first time in 5 years. But also, yes, Jerry Jones wants more. And so his first big move was to fire offensive coordinator Scott Linehan. Reports point to quarterback coach Kellen Moore taking over as OC, with Jason Garrett in line to call plays. Jerry made it clear that he likes the guys in-house more than any other candidates. Stink, what was your reaction to all the moves?
Well, my reaction was, first off, right off the bat, like, when they asked Andy Reid about his defensive coordinator, what did Andy Reid say? I don't answer those questions. I don't talk about firing and hiring people. I'm going to evaluate. And the next day, he fired Bob Sutton, okay? They got done with their season and asked their head coach about his coaching staff and said, hey, we're good, man. Everything is good here. Like, every day.
After Scott making Linehan, significant changes last year and changing the offensive line coach during the season.
Yep. Everything is good here. And then, 2 days later, all of a sudden, Scott Linehan got in his ear, and Scott Linehan's gone, when Dak Prescott essentially had his second best season statistically and continued to progress in a more pro-style situation once they got Amari Cooper. So, I mean, obviously, that's my biggest issue and the reason I don't think the Cowboys are ever really going to win anything under Jerry Jones. It's because you don't ever empower your coach. I mean, come on. Jason Garrett isn't empowered.
Yeah, it's the toughest head coaching job in the NFL.
Yeah, of course it's one of the most high profile, and you get all the money and the stadium, and you're the Dallas Cowboys and America's team and this, that, and the other. But when you consistently come and emasculate your coach after he has said, hey, man, it's my team, I'm keeping my coaches, and 2 days later you got to fire people? There's not a player in that locker room that doesn't understand
who's in charge.
Right, that he is not in charge. And the issue with that is, especially when you have access to the owner, there's a lot of organizations you don't really have as a player access to the owner. You got a back staircase up to Jerry Jones's office if you need to talk to him. And you roll up there as a player, and you can circumvent the coach's authority. And so I just think the structure of the organization is such that when push comes to shove, you're going to have a really tough time winning anything significant in Dallas because of the way they don't ever. Hey, if you're not going to empower Bill Parcells, hell, you ain't empowering anybody to be your head coach.
How does that affect, Nick, the team, or how they play, or how that turns into wins or losses?
Well, I think that you need a singular voice. I shouldn't say you need. It's best to have a singular voice within an organization, whether that is the owner, the team president, the coach. Very rarely have I seen it be successful where it's the owner. I can't think of an instance where the owner was the singular team voice. And we talk about this all the time. When there is a power struggle within G, it's usually usually GM and coach that you don't know who actually is making the decisions. You need to know who do the players go to, who does the coach go to, who does the GM go to. And the problem in Dallas that you're talking about is the GM is the owner, and the GM is the owner who's also kind of anointed himself assistant coach, and so which is one of the reasons we hear about his commentary about the X's and O's of football and his radio interviews, that some of which make sense, some of which don't. And
we run sound bites from the owner more than the head coach.
Absolutely. Here is my bigger issue, though, with Dallas and what they've done since the end of the season, because I thought they might move on from Scott Linehan despite what Jason Garrett had said. Nobody knows if John Kitten is going to do a good job. John Kitten has had three high school jobs, was going to coach in a different league. So anyone that's saying, I know he's going to do great or do terrible, is making it up. Kellen Moore, additionally, has been a quarterback coach for a year. We don't know. But it's very unlikely to me that the very best people for Dak Prescott also happen to be two people who are former Dallas Cowboy backup quarterbacks. It's just unlikely to me that the best person, it's like when a guy gives a company to his son, like, or his daughter, is the best person in the whole world to be the CEO really one of your kids? Or is it just someone who you know and feel comfortable with? Is the best person for the Dallas Cowboys someone, like Jerry's talking about, in the building or that we have comfort with because they've been in the building before? Or if you are going to move on from Linehan, could you use a fresh voice, a fresh perspective, someone that hasn't been there? That, to me, is the concerning point, even though I am not going to be biased against John Kitten or Kellen Moore because we haven't seen what they can and can't do at this level.
Well, one thing I'll say about football right now, football is changing, and it's very, very diverse in what they're trying to do, how they're trying to attack. They're looking at high school football, looking at college football. And for me, having two people that have played in the NFL, John Kitten, I know more than Kellen Moore, and I respect what his football IQ is. But, man, we got people coming from nowhere. I mean, Belichick, if he gets someone from – Belichick got his son coaching the secondary. Now, how in the hell he know about defensive backs? So there's a lot of coaches out there. How they get there and how they're equipped, I'm not going to be the person to sit on television and be like, oh, this guy is good and this guy's not going to be good. But when you've played in the NFL, and we've seen that in the last couple years with Frank Wright and Doug Peterson, they didn't have to play at a high level. But they've been around the NFL. They know things. They know how the game is won, how the ball can be advanced down the field. Those type of things I respect. Kellen Moore, he don't got no great talent. That little raggedy little left arm that he's got, he'd have to be smart to play any time in the NFL. John Kitna is a self-made football player. I covered him when he was in NFL Europe. Yep. So he would have to know a hell of a lot of football to be able to make it to be a starting quarterback in the NFL. So what I believe Dallas needed was every once in a while, man, you just need a fresh makeover. So just some fresh voices in the room to be able to add to what they do. What do? They knock people back. Offensive line, they do that at a high level. Ezekiel Elliott, he runs the football at a high level. It's amazing how smart the coaches got when they got Amari Cooper. So let's just give them a little bit better talent. So I can understand if Dallas said, you know something, we're going to open this up to some new ideas, two or three, to help create more offense for this Dallas Cowboys. I could be for it. But just be a man and stand up there. You know, don't be talking out both sides of your mouth to be able to empower your coaches that way. And I believe Jason Garrett, a long time ago, he should have never stopped calling plays. Man, if I make my money, man, you ain't going to never be able to stop me from calling plays. Look at Andy Reid. Eric Bieniemy, yeah, he's getting some interviews and everything. But when the Chiefs call a play, Big Red, Andy Reid is calling that play. So if they're going to have some fresh ideas in Dallas, I can understand that. But it becomes a thing about respect and continuity. Look at the teams we have here, how much continuity they have on their staff. So that's what the Dallas Cowboys, I believe, need.
My one concern from hiring within is, do you have a voice that will say, no, ain't doing that. You can forget that garbage. We ain't doing that. And I don't know that they have that on their staff, and I don't know that anybody's been empowered to do that. And you have got to. Any great team I've been around, we have had coaches. I mean, my offensive line coach, I have seen my offensive line coach call out my head coach in the hallway, in meetings, and dog cussing. I mean, going after each other. Like, and you,
they were
you think
empowered
that's
to do that.
Right, but you think that's you think it's crazy, but it's actually healthy. We need to challenge each other and say, hey, man, this is not – I don't buy this. I don't believe in this. And this is a recipe for losing football. And if you don't have that interaction and you don't have the ability to have those kind of conversations, the tough kind of conversations, because you've never empowered anybody, everybody's just going to go, oh, yeah, we'll do whatever you want, Jerry, then that's a recipe to continue to lose.
And it doesn't seem like Jerry will ever bring anyone in that would be willing to stand up or that could stand up to him. All right, got to take a break. Coming up, can the Patriots keep playing the underdog role despite being favored in the Super Bowl? That's next. This is First Things First. Mark Schlereth back with us, and it's time for your Subway Choice moment. The Patriots wholeheartedly embraced the role of underdogs in the AFC title game stink, and it worked. Julian Edelman's hashtag bet against us went viral. In fact, during that game, Edelman was seen on the sideline telling Tom Brady, you're too old, as they both laughed. While the underdog mentality worked once, it's hard to believe they can still ride that into their third straight Super Bowl. But, Mark, can the Patriots actually still motivate themselves by playing this underdog card?
Absolutely. I mean, that becomes real. In a locker room, that stuff is real. It's not only the underdog, but how much America hates them. How much people are rooting against them, all that stuff. All that stuff is real.
All that stuff is real, Steve. But let me ask you a different question.
Okay, good.
Do you think Bill Belichick one time will mention that we're underdogs?
No.
Oh, okay. Now you can proceed.
Right.
Why does a team like the Patriots need it? The Patriots do everything by the book. They are so prepared. They're the best game-planning team we talk about. Why would they need something else to try to fuel
them? So listen, I think we've got to recognize the circumstances that led to
this. We have to recognize who the Patriots are, and what they're saying in these little sound bites compared to what Bill Belichick teaches.
And we've got to – hold on. So the Pats actually were underdogs last week. For just the second time in a decade in the playoffs and the first time in 67 consecutive Brady starts. So that was a card they never actually were able to play, that they finally could play it. Say, hey, you know what? We actually are underdogs, so we're going to play this card. Then there's Julian Edelman, who, as Sia has talked about, is a legitimate underdog. Now, he's an annoying underdog at this point. Like, everyone forgets about the PED suspension. Wasn't even there last year. Doesn't matter. Whatever. He's selling his T-shirts with it. Fine.
Moving on.
But he's undersized. He had to switch positions. He wasn't very highly recruited. That's how you end up at Kent State. So he actually probably is an underdog. And his best buddy on the team, Tom Brady, has convinced himself that he was an underdog to begin his career. At some point, he became the greatest quarterback ever, but he has kept the same mindset of people doubt me.
Yes.
People don't think I can do it. So for those two guys, I understand why it started with Brady saying, we suck, can't win any games after the Charger game. Then Edelman's selling his merch. Then they're talking to each other after the Chiefs game saying, you're too slow, you're too old, and bro hug. Like, fine. But for the Patriots as a team, I don't think it's real, and it is not sellable, which is, I think, Chris's point, which is why Belichick's not going to try to sell it. Like, when you guys were the defending Super Bowl champs with John Elway and Terrell Davis and your offensive line and Shannon Sharp, my guess is Mike Shanahan wasn't telling you guys in meetings, nobody believes in us. Like, because you guys wouldn't have bought – maybe I'm wrong. Tell me if I'm wrong. But
he
I don't
had
think
one
you guys
time to pull that car.
Bought it in the locker
room. And that's when they faced the invincible –
Green Bay Packers.
And Green Bay was so amazing.
Right, and that was before they were the defending Super Bowl champs.
Right.
That was your guys' first Super Bowl in Denver.
Yeah, and there was no question that that was real, and we used that. You know, I mean, nobody, they can't beat us. I mean, one of the things that they did in that particular game, pregame, is they put one of their defensive linemen down. And for us in the locker room, that was a sign.
What do you mean? They didn't activate him.
They deactivated one of their defensive linemen. And we're in that locker room, we're like, the disrespect that was felt was palpable.
So let me just explain to the audience real quick. You seven guys are going to be inactive, and if you deactivate a healthy defensive lineman, what they're saying to you is, we don't need our full rotation.
We don't need our full rotation
to
defeat you guys. You guys won't be able to run against us.
Right.
We can just play without our normal rotation. We can just play one guy short and still beat you. And we're like, well, we run it against everybody. Like, why would you think we can't run against? Because you're bigger than us? That doesn't matter to us. So that stuff is palpable. That is real. The fact that Brady continues after 18 years to play the I didn't get drafted till the sixth round, and I've got the names of every guy that got drafted before me still hanging in my locker, like, that's real. Mm-hmm. And that's that permeates other guys. I mean, that's the way he approaches the game. So, yeah, are they the underdogs? No, they're not the underdogs. But those things are still motivating factors for them. And if it helps you prepare during the week and stay focused and do the things Bill Belichick asks you to do, you're going to have success on Sundays.
So why does it seem like this is the first year that we're really hearing about them even coming close to pulling
because
that card?
Because this was the first year that it was pullable. They lost five games. They were bad on the road. They had a road AFC championship game.
They lost in a way that New England would never lose
the Miami
game.
The Miami game you're talking about?
Situational football.
Right.
It's one of the reasons why the folks in Boston who are still tweeting at me to this day think I should feel some embarrassment for being wrong. I don't feel bad about what I said about the Patriots this year. They ended up playing their best football at the end of the year, but I wasn't making it up. This wasn't a 14-2 team that I just said, you know what? They stink. There were five teams in the NFL with a better record than them. There were two teams in their own conference with a better record than them. There were real reasons, real seeds of doubt that they planted throughout the year by their play in their road games in particular.
Their desperation at wide receiver. 33 receivers have come to New England Patriots since the spring. They lost their best wide receiver a couple days after the Pittsburgh game. The big losses on the road. The 3-5 record. All these things also led by a quarterback who will never let it go. That combine, him getting benched at Michigan, them believing in the baseball player, Drew Henson,
yes,
over him, that will always be with Tom Brady. But Bill Belichick, he doesn't coach that way. So when you ask that, that's what I'm separating between the two. They got a couple guys on New England, but their safety, Chung, he don't feel like I'm some underdog. They don't feel like I don't have no talent.
Gilmore,
Dante
Trey
Hightower won multiple championships at Alabama. Sony Michel is a five-star running back from Florida, went to Georgia, and dominated in college football. They got talented players, so you can't tell that story to people who aren't talented. A couple people adopt that little mantra, and that's in Edelman. He'll always have that in their leader in Tom Brady. It's just not preached in that locker room by Bill Belichick.
I 100% agree with you. But in that locker room, those defensive players, you can't tell me they don't feel slighted. You don't think Van Noy is irritated that he doesn't get any love as a really good football player? Like, when you look at them as a defensive front, what do you hear from them? Well, they don't have one guy. It's about scheme. It's about – they don't have one, legit, big-time superstar pass rusher.
You know, they don't have Patriots players through the years in working with them and talking with them, the one thing they hate is people say we're not talented. They take that as an impersonal indictment. So they do have that. Saying it's the scheme, saying it's the coach, saying it's Tom Brady. Right. When Malcolm Butler intercepts the ball, everyone's like, Tom Brady's the greatest. Malcolm Butler won you a Super Bowl.
Right.
So they are very, very talented.
Yeah, I mean, that
all
you can't
right.
say any better than that. That's what makes them mad, and that's what inspires them to continue to play this underdog type of card.
Sting, thanks so much for hanging
pleasure.
With us. Coming up, has James Harden turned himself into the best player in the NBA? That's next on First Things First. Saturday to welterweight title fight as undefeated Keith Thurman defends his belt against Josecito Lopez live from Barclays Center Saturday at 8 Eastern only on Fox and the Fox Sports app.
Going to that fight, see? Barclays in Brooklyn Saturday night.
I'm a little busy, man. I got a couple of things I'm trying to work out right now.
Okay, no problem.
We'll get to James Harden's big night in a second, but first, college basketball. This is Tennessee's Jordan Bowden flushing home the one-handed dunk off the inbounds play.
So a lot of times you see the attempted alley-oop off the inbounds from a stack formation along the lane line. This guy coming in from the weak side three-point line is one of the reasons it works. And an excellent toss, and he had to go up and get it now.
Oh, Tennessee's got a nice basketball team. They're going to make some noise in the tournament.
I think they're the number one team in the AP poll, latest one, after Duke had to hold that L to Syracuse.
To the NBA now, Hawks and Bulls. Justin Anderson drives, then puts Bobby Portis on a poster.
Bobby P, man, you got to either get there and take a charge or you got to get up above the rim. You can't do halfway because this would have happened.
And it's an and one. It's not. Listen, I respect the effort, Bobby Portis, but you ain't out there for your jump, for your silky smooth jump shot. Got to do some little rim protection, my man. said he gets boomed on by Justin Anderson.
It's the Bulls in the highlights again?
Yeah, but this time getting dunked on.
We lead the league in worst
Bulls highlights.
The worst teams. Suns.
That was a Hawks Bulls
highlight. All right, this one's your guy, see. Jazz Nuggets, Donovan Mitchell hits Will Barton with a Euro
step. See, out of his sophomore slump the last month.
Oh, man, they're playing some good basketball in Utah. Off to a rough start. No, Ben Simmons in his third year, which is like his sophomore year. You know,
Ben Simmons coming to this?
Big Euro step. Man, he got some big feet, too. I think he'd wear at least a size 15.
He also had a key block in this game. This is a good game if you wanted to stay up late and watch it.
Moving on to James Harden, we are running out of ways to describe the historic run that he's been on. It continued last night as the Rockets visited the Knicks. Harden poured in a career-high 61 and had 15 boards in Houston's win at the Garden. It was Harden's fifth game with at least 50 this season and the first time a player has had 60 and 15 since Shaq. All the way back in 2000. Rockets GM Daryl Morey was on our show yesterday and talked about Harden's development as a player.
I would say the main thing was when you looked at him at Oklahoma City is even when he wasn't on the floor with Durant and Westbrook, and we track everything, as you guys know, his drives to the hoop were the most efficient. I mean, he was like multiple standard deviations to the right. That's how we look at things. Like, he's one of the very unique players in history, the ability to drive and either score or create something for his teammates.
All right, CeCe, when you think about James Harden and how far he's come to where he is right now, how has he been able to grow his game to this level?
There's a few things. I would say from a cardio standpoint, he's done a tremendous job as being able to take care of his body. He doesn't have an elite body. He doesn't have a really cut-up body like some of the muscle tone we see in some of the other. He's not as slender as some of the other stars we see in the league. But you can see that he's changed his eating regimen, what he's doing from a workout rate, because you can see his body has changed into being where he is now. Also, the reason why you know it's working is because you can't play that style of basketball of holding the ball, pick and roll, all those types of things, and play with the type of energy that he's played at to be able to not be able to change his regimen. Number two, his jump shot from deep. It's gotten so much better, and variations of how he can get to that jump shot, either off a dribble, either off a step back, which is one of a kind in all of basketball. And the third thing, the GM talked about his ability to get to the hole, his ability to dribble the basketball now and get to the hole even more efficiently. Those three things right there have changed his game. Dribbling, shooting, just the fundamentals, and overall, I'm going to take care of my body to allow me to play harder longer.
So let's talk about the take care of your body part for a moment, because there's an element to this that I think people in NBA circles know, and we don't necessarily talk about that much, which is when James Harden first got to Houston, man, he was on the going out every night all-star team. I'd been in Houston. He'd been in Houston 6 months, and I looked it up before the show. The tweet's still up. I sent out a tweet back in 2013 of a picture in a gentleman's club in Houston. They had hung his jersey in the rafters because he was there all the time during the season, during the offseason. He's cut that part, I don't want to say totally out of his life, but minimized it. Focused more on staying in good condition. Like you guys would talk about eating healthier because of the tremendous workload he has to take on. That's first point. Second point is there was, even when he was coming in second in MVP votes, there was the compilation of his horrific defensive clips.
I mean, the lack of effort, the lack of fundamental, and didn't care.
And didn't appear to be paying attention at times. Just have a guy like he's standing there, a guy runs right past him, wouldn't. He took that personally. Now, no one thinks Harden's an all-NBA defender, but with his level of offense, he just can't be a horrible defender. And so he became a passable.
And you can see that in the number of steals he has currently.
And the lack of those clips of him just having a guy go right past him. And the last thing is that step back. That step back. His ability to develop, because he has shot around the same percentage from three every year of his career, but he's a better three-point shooter now because he does it, they're so much harder, and he's doing it at such a higher volume. So it's one thing to shoot 37% when you're shooting four a game.
As a role player.
Right, exactly.
And Russ is on the court with you, and KD's on the court with you.
And so now they are hard shots. They are contested shots. They are shots he has to create, as evidenced by in these last five games, he's averaged 52 a game, and none of his buckets have been assisted by his teammates. So he is scoring in the hardest way possible. And I'm glad we asked this question, Jenna, because people, there's for how great he's been, he gets a bad rap because of the officiating, because of some tough playoff moments, because of the old defensive clips. The amount of work you have to put in after getting two max contracts, after coming close to winning an MVP, winning an MVP, say, I want to grow my game. I want to get better. I want to get to the next level. A lot of guys don't do that. A lot of guys say, if I can just maintain here, he did not have this step back three the way he did does this year, last year. And that's what, that's to me, the biggest reason why instead of scoring 30 a game, he's up to 36 a game. It's the reason why he's been able to carry this team while they have dealt with devastating injuries to their second and third best player.
The best five players in the world, all of them in some different form or fashion, have worked on their game. Starting at the top with LeBron, it's legendary, him and Kyrie working on his overall dribbling. We know LeBron was challenged to be able to shoot the ball. We know how he worked on that.
Kyle Korver with his free throws.
I mean, yep. KD has worked on it. All he talks about is, I'm going to the gym to be able to score the basketball. How he can score in so many different varieties. Steph, with his body, now his overall endurance. He can shoot his range anywhere on the court. His playmaking off the dribble. So these types of players, Giannis in the weight room has gotten better, better. Now he's shooting a three-pointer. Now he's off the dribble. So all the great players, the top five players, all of them have Harden-ish type of tendencies that they've worked on their game, and the worst parts of their game have gotten significantly better.
And the part that Harden's game, he still doesn't get enough credit for, and Daryl alluded to it yesterday, and when we talk about averaging 40 points a game for a month and a half, leading the league and scoring 36 a night, the points he creates for his teammates on his drive and kick, his ability to create open corner threes, the best shot in basketball for his teammates, he is as good as anyone in the sport at that. So he's not a selfish player because he's scoring this much, because his baskets are unassisted. He's still top five in the NBA in assists. While scoring at this level, he's the best offensive player in the sport right now, and there's not a close second that's currently playing.
All right, let's take a break. Coming up, what's the key for Jared Goff against the Patriots defense? That's next on First Things First. Back here on First Things First, we're going viral. The pass interference no call in the NFC Championship game left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths, with Michael Thomas leading the charge. So he posted this. It's a picture of the Super Bowl 53 logo. See if you can find the ever so slight tweak.
Well, it appears to say lie.
It does say lie.
I think that's the tweak.
Mm-hmm.
The little bars on the horizontal bars on the what should be the third Roman numeral.
Uh-huh.
Man, Michael Thomas, he was tweeting out the official, like, paragraph in the rule book, section 17, paragraph 2, which is that says Roger Goodell has the ability to overturn any result if something manifestly unfair happened. And then he'd send out a tweet that said, make the call, Roger. Like, he ain't over it, man. You got to call your guy, Michael Thomas, your Ohio State guy, and see if he's doing okay. You got to check on him.
I mean, who can recover from two tough losses? The Minneapolis Miracle and then the not pass interference call this year? That's a tough way to get beat. There's only way to recover from that, Michael Thomas. Give him about $70 million, $40 million guaranteed. Yeah. I guarantee he'll stop tweeting to the commissioner's office.
Time now for stories to start your morning.
Yep, ski mask season.
Tough news for the Pacers last night. Victor Oladipo suffered a serious injury to his right knee. He'll have an MRI today, but the Pacers fear they have lost him for the year. Nick, how devastating is this?
I feel terribly for him. This is one of the best stories in basketball. He was number two overall pick. People thought he was disappointing, almost a bust. And then on his third team, getting back to the state of Indiana, turned into a star. They damn near ended the Cavs' reign in the East last year, taking them seven, took some LeBron heroics. What was most concerning to me, C, and you pointed it out as well, They used the towel to cover up his knee injury because of how it looked for the players on the court. That strikes me as a very serious knee injury.
Yeah, it's no normal knee injury. We wish him a speedy recovery. Great story there. When they lose their face of their franchise, Paul George, they go out and get him, play basketball there in the state at Indiana. I hope him a speedy recovery, but just watch for some news coming out. Let's just see. Let's just hope for the best. We hope it's a ACL, MCL, or PCL. That's it.
All right, moving on. Larry Fitzgerald has agreed to a one-year deal to return to the Cardinals for a 16th season. Fitzgerald ranks second in NFL history in receiving yards, third in receptions, and is tied for sixth in receiving touchdowns. See, what do you think about Fitz returning next season?
Well, Larry's happy. He's healthy enough to continue playing football. I like to win. I'm not into losing, so I'm not into my guy losing. All right? I wish he was on a winner. I know how the Bidwells and them feel about him. No player is bigger in their community than Larry is in that Arizona area, but I'm about winning.
Let me give you a little bit of hope then, maybe. Just a little bit. Silver lining. Listen, nobody thought...
Stab me in my neck.
Nobody thought year two of Jared Goff was going to go the way it went. You got a new head coach. You still have David Johnson. You got Fitzy. If Josh Rosen can bounce back, we see a team go from worst to first every year in this league. So I don't think we can say definitively he's going to be on a losing team. But this is out of love for football. He's made more money than any wide receiver ever by a wide margin. He's not going to get to number one in yards. He needs 6,000 to catch Jerry Rice. So it's not about moving up the record books. It's about his love for that community, I believe, and his love to keep playing football. And maybe Josh Rosen turns around next year. See? We don't know.
No, we do know.
Okay.
Move on to the Lakers now. LeBron will sit tonight against the T-Wolves, still nursing his groin injury. But even without LeBron, Lakers are leaving a good impression around the league. Kevin Durant said that he thinks they're going to be a team to be reckoned with in the playoffs, assuming they make the playoffs. Nick, what do you think? Is KD right?
Listen, I haven't changed my belief on the Lakers that they can beat any team in the West when they're fully healthy outside of Golden State. So I think a lot of it's going to depend on how they fall in the bracket. Are they on the same side as Golden State? Do they fall in such a big hole that they play Golden State in the first round as the 8 seed? I don't think that's likely. I think they're more likely going to be in that 5-7 range. What has not impressed anyone around the league is the development of Brandon Ingram. And Brandon Ingram, now teams are calling to potentially trade for him, not because he's shown so much, but because they think his value might right now actually be plump, like at a low point to where they could buy low on him. But the LeBron thing, to me, the outlier in this, or the question in this, the variable I should say, is how is LeBron going to respond to the first significant injury of his career? We do not know. We can think we know, but he doesn't know either. He's never been out of basketball this long.
Respond production-wise or just mentally?
I think mentally he'll be fine, but what will he be in the shape he's used to being in? Will one injury lead to more? Like, we can hope that's not the case. We can hope this was an outlier, just strained groin, but foot slid a little too far, but we are in unprecedented territory now with LeBron James, an athlete who up until 2 months ago had been the most durable athlete in NBA history, this side of Karl Malone, now suffering a significant injury that's going to cost him a quarter of his season.
Yeah, but let's not blow it out of proportion, because he is one of the greater athletes we've ever seen. We've never seen someone's career altered by a growing strain.
No.
So when he gets back, NBA players, they don't come back until they're healthy. So he's not going to come back at 70%. It's not like the NFL. He's not going to get on the court, which he just got on the court playing with the Lakers recently. He's not going to get on the court till he's healthy. So I'm not worried about his overall productivity when he comes back, because I know he won't get on the court until he's healthy. What Kevin Durant did here was two things. He gave LeBron the ultimate compliment. And that is that guy right there, whoever he's playing with, he's going to be something that I have to reckon with. I like the fact that KD understands that now, because there's nothing worse than getting into the postseason and thinking a team's not going to be good and you have to be able to face them. It's a lot like Philadelphia when they had to face New Orleans again. New Orleans had to trick themselves because they had blew them out the time before. That's why I thought it was going to be a harder game for them, because they didn't give Philadelphia that type of respect. I believe that's the right attitude to have for Golden State and for Kevin Durant, because the last 2 years, KD saw, even with him taking home the MVP, that guy with four blind people gave us a run for our money. So anybody LeBron has with him can challenge us, because we have seen him with no help give us problems, even though the games won, the margins weren't as close as people would. Kevin Durant knows.
Kevin Durant, yeah, I think they learned that lesson in game one of the NBA Finals last year. I think the Warriors looked at, and I think most people looked at, the real NBA Finals, Warriors-Rockets. They were able to overcome the 3-2 deficit. They went into those NBA Finals seeing what we all saw from the Cavs, that they needed 7 to beat Indiana. They needed 7 to beat an injured Boston team. And then game one, the Cavs had them thanks to what LeBron did until a weird call on the J.R. Smith gaffe at the end. So I do think that's the point, that they, no matter what the Lakers look like now, when LeBron comes back, they are the team, as much as the Rockets, that the Warriors need to be on guard against. I just think nobody really believes the Warriors have to be truly on guard against really anybody this
year. And then quickly, are we any closer to a timeline on LeBron?
Oh, I think LeBron's going to come back after the Phoenix game. He's going to miss the Minnesota game, miss the Phoenix game. I think he's going to come back after the Phoenix game.
All right, let's get back to the Super Bowl now. While it is pretty evenly matched, that according to Vegas and all, the quarterback matchup seems slightly one-sided. Jared Goff heading to his first ever Super Bowl. Tom Brady basically invented the Super Bowl. Goff, who floundered in year one, has prospered in year two and three. And after the win on Sunday, offensive tackle Andrew Whitworth heaped praise on the young quarterback.
You know what? He's just a special kid. I've said it since, you know, we really came to training camp, and really since the day I met him, I've realized that he's a special kid. And you know what? I told my wife before this playoff started, this is the first year that I really didn't, it really wasn't about me. I really honestly felt like I was more nervous for this playoffs because I believe in Jared Goff, and I believe that he deserves to win. And I just want to be right about that. And that's what it means the most to me, and I can't be more proud of him.
All right, CC, when Jared Goff sits down to start thinking about facing this Patriots defense, what's going to be the key for him?
Man, he's got to be able to make some throws, make some plays. They're going to give him a couple of different looks, just making sure he doesn't panic. And I just believe that he gets the wake-up call at the beginning of the game compared to the wake-up call Patty Mahomes got. Because in those first couple series, there were guys open. Those were matchups that Kansas City could have taken advantage of New England and type of coverage, but Patty Mahomes couldn't get to it. It took him till halftime to be able to make that adjustment. Jared Goff early, they're going to have a very good game plan. I just believe early in the game that he's got to be able to run the football. I don't look at these matchups as being, oh, they got Tom Brady. On the other side, they got Jared Goff. It's one-sided. No, in last year's Super Bowl, Nick Foles, who is not a better quarterback than Jared Goff, all right? He went toe-to-toe with Tom Brady. So I believe with the game plan, with the offense that they have, Jared Goff, especially early, they're going to try to take someone away in this offense, figuring out who that is and going to the matchup that I want, because they're going to give you a matchup. They got to be able to get to that early. His ability to be able to run the ball, because I know New England, they're not expecting him to run the ball. If I'm Sean McVay, I'm running some RPOs early, and I hope the quarterback runs, because it would immediately make New England change part of their game plan. All right, it would immediately put them on the defensive, all right, and you can make them start to play left-handed. They don't have great speed at linebacker. I believe they're going to be committing their linebackers to a lot of run stunts to be able to take C.J. Anderson and Todd Gurley out of the game. And that's where I believe Jared Goff, there's going to be yards to be made. And with the protection of the quarterback, I'm utilizing my feet if I'm Jared Goff and getting a couple first downs early.
So you mentioned earlier about Jared Goff running as part of a way to attack the Pats defense, and it surprised me because you think of the young quarterbacks. We know Wentz make plays with legs. Mahomes, obviously Watson. Mitch Trubisky does. Josh Allen, seemingly all he does. Lamar Jackson as well. Goff, not one of those guys you think of as a guy who can be a great athlete. But the point is, I think what you're saying is, and you said it there, is that even if Jared Goff running the ball is not a huge weapon for them, the ability to make New England adjust because it's not what you anticipate the Rams wanting to do, making New England adjust what their defense is, which is something they didn't have to do against the Chiefs until midway through the fourth quarter, that's what you're talking about, right?
Well, they're going to play a lot of man-to-man. It's not only the adjustment. I believe there's big plays to be made. The defenders are going to be running with their back to the quarterback. They do not have exceptional speed at linebacker. So it's not about being a good athlete. It's about opportunities available on the football field. That's why I believe Jared Goff, with his legs, would hurt the New England defense.
And I don't think Goff got enough credit for what happened at the end of the NFC Championship game after the blown call. The blown call, the Saints still kicked a field goal, take the lead. You're still on the road, trip to the Super Bowl on the line, down with less than 2 minutes left and one timeout. And he drove them to the 31-yard line. Like, he drove them to Verzuerlein, what is a very makeable 48-yard field goal. Now, there's not much Goff had to do in the overtime drive because of where the interception was thrown, and they often stalled, and Zuerlein then hit a 57-yarder. But we are not talking about the controversy surrounding the blown call if the Saints win the game. And the reason they didn't win the game was because that Rams offense, that passing attack, was effective enough to get in field goal range to tie the game. I've been really impressed with Goff. I was really impressed with Goff on Sunday. His ability to deal with that element of the crowd noise and that stage. I understand the Super Bowl is a bigger stage.
No, but his composure in that game was also remarkable.
Right. The Super Bowl is going to sound like a lot of Rams home games sound like. Split crowd. Like, it's going to feel like a bigger moment, but nothing sounded to him like what that first half, first quarter in particular of that Saints game sounded like, and that game started terribly. He threw a good pass to Todd Gurley, goes off his hands, and it ends up being an interception. Their ability and his ability to rally from that with Todd Gurley on the bench, that to me, those are big moments now. Those are moments that make me reevaluate how I've been looking at Jared Goff as just a participant in the Rams' success as opposed to a leading factor in
the Rams'
success.
And a lot of times people give all the credit to Sean McVay as far as Jared Goff and his overall growth. They did a lot of important things after Jared Goff's first season. Sean McVay as a head coach was one of them. Then it was a domino effect. Who did Sean McVay, who did their front office, Les Snead, who'd they go get? They went and got Wade Phillips. They went and got Andrew Whitworth. They got grown men. Andrew Whitworth coming from Cincinnati, he was 35 at the time. Yeah. That's his blindside protector. So the things that they've done for Jared Goff to be able to support him has allowed him to be able to grow as a quarterback. I believe he's going to be an elite quarterback in the NFL. We're system players. He's got a great system, and I like the guy calling the plays and direction in Sean McVay.
All right, let's take a break. Leave it there. Coming up is Jerry Jones on the verge of making a big mistake. That's next on First Things First. What? The Sixers took down the Spurs last night, 122-120. And though Brett Brown got the win over his mentor, Greg Popovich, he called Pop the best coach ever. Pop took the compliment just like you'd expect him to. Say what?
Brett Brown said you're the greatest coach that the NBA has ever seen.
I'm so full.
That's why I got rid of him. Kiss ass.
Is this the start of DeJounte traveling, being around the coaching staff?
I'll give you that laugh at my joke.
You hear what he said? That's what I ask you guys all the time. How come you're not laughing at my joke?
Oh, I didn't hear the very end of it. I heard him say he's full of bleep, and why we got rid of him.
And then the reporter didn't laugh. Okay for him to say it.
Well, no, I didn't. I'm sorry. I didn't hear his joke.
Exactly.
That's always, Jenna, that's what I just realized.
What?
When I don't laugh at your jokes, you think it's because... I just don't hear.
Oh, you don't hear.
I don't hear well out of this year.
Likely excuse.
We should. I've got the IFB in this year, and I don't hear well out of this year.
You liar.
Old football injury.
You lie. So I never played football.
We should just switch seats or
never
something.
Never played
be
football.
Be funnier.
Anyway, Pop's a funny guy. Serious, but funny.
No, Pop's a very funny guy. And that's without a bottle and a half of red wine in him. Pop's a very funny guy. There's no doubt about that. What, Chris
What's up,
Carter?
See? Say something.
Say something.
I would love to work with someone like Pop because Jenna Wolf is not funny.
Oh, come
Nick
on.
Wright.
Oh, well, listen.
Jenna,
I don't
whoever told you
funny
were funny,
life.
That's part of our problem.
All my friends think I'm very funny. It's the environment
curve.
Is
remember,
a little different.
See, do you remember
really?
The car we were in?
Yeah.
Do you remember the car we were in Columbus, Ohio when I thought I solved so many of our, when we were first getting started? And I said, Chris, I've got it. You got to recognize when Jenna's with her friends, what is she? She's the cool one. Jenna's the edgy one. She's the cool one. And she then takes that motif elsewhere, and it's not transferable.
No.
He ain't Marnie,
all
nor
right.
is he Marcy.
Right.
Okay.
We got a staff of 15, and okay. Jenna ranks 15th as far as woke, cool, and or funny.
Not
holla, holla.
Rue or
if I don't
any
never say nothing
things.
Else on TV. Take me to my grave on that one.
back to the Cowboys now.
Jesus, grab the mic.
And we're all awake. They just won a playoff game for the first time in 5 years, but Jerry Jones wants more. Reports point to quarterback coach Kellen Moore taking over for Scott Linehan as offensive coordinator, with Jason Garrett in line to call plays. Jerry made it clear that he likes the guys in-house more than any other candidate. See, how big is the gap between the Cowboys offense and the teams that we saw on Championship Sunday?
Well, I don't think it's that much difference between the types of offenses that we saw first time in NFL history. The first four ranked offense as far as points that they were in the final four. No, we saw how much better they got with Amari Cooper. Now, imagine even if they just stayed the same, they have one offseason with Amari Cooper. You add him with Dak Prescott and what they have, their tight ends are going to get better. Michael Gallup's going to get better. So even if they were doing the same thing, they would be better.
They got Travis Frederick coming back
this next year. I mean, we know the wholesale changes they had on the offensive line based on injuries. No, they would be better. Now you start to add just a few other wrinkles. I like to continue to add more speed for more deep threats. I know that the tight end position is going to become more important this offseason. So, no, I don't think they're that far apart. But some of those things, how effective can you throw the deep ball? Can you take better care of the football? Can you be better in the red zone? These are all things that they can do with the current group that they have. So if you're going to be elite offensively, I do believe just a little bit of tinkering, Dallas can be an elite offense.
Are these the moves that they just made, Linehan bringing Kellen Moore, are these, even the play calling to Jason Garrett, enough of a moves to bridge that gap?
Well, listen, I know Chris believes that Jason Garrett always should have been calling plays, that that's how he made his money, that he never should have given up that opportunity. As far as Kellen Moore, I don't discount a guy's ability to be a good coach just because he wasn't a good player. In fact, and I know that sounds rude to Kellen Moore, but he was a very good college player at Boise State, and that's, it was a kind of
amazing. Yeah, let's not throw this out there because a guy's not good in the NFL, he can't play football.
Right.
I mean, there's only a few guys that can play football.
That's why I was trying to clarify.
Yeah,
a good NFL player is
Yeah,
was,
absolutely.
That's what
we, need
to,
say that, and because so, most of the coaches in the NFL, I mean, they couldn't even play damn high school football any good.
And so the point is, I think, oddly enough, the coaches that didn't have an NFL career, they don't have the, obviously, they ended their careers in high school, to your point. We don't hold that against them. But guys that we saw play and not play well, sometimes we hold that against them, even though they achieved at a level or two above the guys who ended in high school. And we have seen in a lot of instances in sports, the best players are not the best coaches because things come naturally to them, because they can't teach what they were able to do. I don't know if Kellen Moore is going to be an upgrade on Scott Linehan. I do know this. I thought they needed a change at offensive coordinator. I thought that they could. There weren't many plays that I saw the Cowboys running this year, and we watched them very closely, where it's like, wow, that guy was schemed wide open, like we see with some of what I think the sharper offensive minds. My concern is, and with the report that John Kitna might be coming over as well, is not whether or not Kitna can do it. It's my concern whenever the person you hire is the person you're familiar with. What are the odds that the people most equipped to run the Cowboys offense are all guys who played quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys? That's my level of concern. Like, could you use someone, a fresh look, not a fresh face necessarily, but a fresh voice to come in and say, hey, here's how we've done things in other organizations, and it can work here with your personnel. I'm not putting a ceiling on it, but there's no, to me, sometimes teams err on the side of familiarity,
sure,
rather than what maybe could help them take the next step.
It just seems like a guy like Jerry Jones would want to go out and shop for what he deems to be the best at everything he could bring in. And you're right, it would just be a coincidence that that in-house, like those candidates are the best at every position that he has on that team.
Well, the thing about it, it's not always who's best, who's the smartest, who knows the most. It's about continuity. And if he is going to empower Jason Garrett, he needs to be able to give people Jason Garrett's comfortable with. So if they bring someone in outside the organization and Jason Garrett is going to call the plays, did you actually help him by bringing one voice outside the organization compared to they feel like they have enough good concrete ideas and concepts inside that room currently that they could expand this offense? But it has a lot to do with personnel. But the reason why I trust the people they have now is because I don't see anyone inside the offense who's been underutilized. Someone who is uber, uber talented, and they're not utilizing them. So for me, if you get more talented players, the coaches can do more with those players. I just believe from a concept standpoint, they have one or two new little concepts they could add and make this offense better.
And what have we seen with a lot of these coaches that were hired this offseason, whether it was Cliff Kingsbury in Arizona, whether it was the former Dolphins head coach Gase with the Jets. It's been about
who's good looking.
Well, okay, sure.
Oh,
also,
sorry.
Who can help our young quarterback?
Right.
And so if they believe that Kellen Moore in his 1 year quarterback coaching Dak Prescott is going to be able to help him get to the next level, where we saw Dak have a really tough first half of his season and make enormous strides in the second half of his season once Amari Cooper got there, the real ceiling that's on the Cowboys offense at the moment is how good can they be throwing the football vertically down the field? Yes, they need a tight end. They need Michael Gallup to develop. They obviously desperately needed Amari Cooper. They also need a more consistent level of production from Dak. Is this the brain trust that you trust to do that? If it is, then it's the right decision. It's about how much their fourth-year quarterback now can develop, especially as we think he's going to become a fourth-year expensive quarterback, and you're not going to have as much resources to put all those weapons around it.
Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern. For Chris Carter and Nick Wright, I'm Jenna Wolf. So long, everybody.